From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 63 for Friday, the 17th of February, 2012. On the show today, the UK breeds and kills 800 million chickens in battery farms every year, but one man has a radical suggestion for a more humane way to do so. Britain gets its first amphibious house, and why is our own Olivia Solon donating her brain to science when she dies? All that and more coming up. Ahoy there, I'm Nate Langson, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, as per usual every week, Duncan Gear, our news editor.
Hello.
And associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
Now, we're a bit late recording this week because Apple kindly re-announced a new episode of OS X. We're not going to talk about it in the news, but it's called Mountain Lion.
Did you say episode?
What did I say?
You said episode of OS X.
Well, it's an episode in Apple's...
Is it actually OS X? I thought it was OS X.
Well, it's...
I mean, I know X is the Roman numeral for 10 and everything,
We
but...
They do say OS X. It's OS 10.8, specifically.
I've always said OS X.
Okay. Well, yeah. It's OS X, and it's called Mountain Lion. It's going to be out in the summer. Anyway, that's all we're going to talk about for Apple. We've got a few things to get to today, and we're going to start with Soca. Now, Duncan, a blog... had some controversy on it the other day.
Yeah, before we start, we should probably say this has nothing to do with SOPA, which we have discussed in recent podcasts. SOCA is the UK's Serious Organised Crimes Agency, which normally deals with things like human trafficking and drugs and vast counterfeiting operations. But it suddenly started to stick its oar into the world of copyright infringement, seizing the domain of a music blog called R&B Exclusive.
Now, this is a music blog, and there are many others like it on the web, that periodically posts downloads for music it does not always have the licenses to offer for download.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, music PR companies will send music blogs MP3s for them to post up with the objective of course, getting more coverage for their bands.
Yeah.
But in a lot of cases, music blogs will also post MP3s that aren't, they haven't got the permission to post. They make them available for download and that's it. And that seems to be what the problem is here. They posted too many of those. And so the Serious Organized Crimes Agency, SOCA, has seized their domain and it was taken down and you now can't get to the site at all.
But there's something pretty fishy about this case in particular.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. First of all, because it's the first time that another country, in this case the UK, has been able to seize a .com domain, which has always previously been seen as the kind of jurisdiction of the US Department of Justice, and they've always been involved in takedowns before. So it's kind of weird that Britain has been able to do that without any sign of any kind of interaction with the states. It's possible that that happened, but yeah, we don't know. And the second slightly weird thing is the nature of the splash page that was left after the takedown, sort of talking about how the operator's been arrested for fraud, and that that people who had downloaded MP3s from the site faced, and I quote, 10 years in jail and an unlimited fine. I'm not entirely convinced that's true.
No, because, I mean, those sort of penalties are generally the domain, so to speak, of massively organized criminal activities for profiting.
Yeah.
And
profit and commercial scale downloading is a crime that would carry a sentence of kind of 10 years in jail or an unlimited fine. But downloading for personal use, if somebody was convicted and given a sentence like that, it would be utterly unprecedented. It would be very, very odd to see that happen.
But they're just saying that because it's been taken down for fraud reasons, they're saying that fraud is the 10-year, could be the potentially give a 10-year
Well, no,
sentence.
I mean, what they were saying on the site is that anyone downloading MP3s from the site faced that sentence,
okay.
Whereas it wouldn't be the operators. I mean, yes, it's true that the operators are facing those kinds of charges, and it remains to be seen whether they do get convicted for that. It's way too early to tell. But yeah, and then the site went on to say, if you've illegally downloaded music, you've damaged the future of the record industry and hurt the careers of young artists. And it just started reading very, very oddly for an agency like the Serious Organized Crimes Agency to be saying.
Yeah, it sounds very much like it was written by the music industry. I mean, obviously this takedown has been in association with music industry bodies.
But yeah, they're almost certain to be involved at some level of this.
Yeah, there's no way that Serious Crime Agency would write something as, you know, prolific as you have damaged the careers of young artists.
And puppies and their little eyes are watering as you speak.
But they didn't say that.
They didn't.
Yeah, and I think as well the danger of that kind of scaremongering from the copyright industries is it does remind people of exactly how disproportionate punishments for copyright violations are. compared to, I don't know, if you do go and steal a CD from a shop, you're not going to get 10 years in prison and an unlimited fine, are you?
No, but that's the thing. I mean, particularly in this country, I mean, no one's going to jail for downloading an MP3. You know, the most likely outcome is getting your broadband cut off or getting a small fine that's an inconvenience and it's more to ward it off.
The threats are still there and kind of interestingly, actually, there was a lot of attention from the web to those threats over the last couple of days. And perhaps in response to that, Soka has now taken that splash screen down and now just displays a message that the domain has been seized. So it's not entirely clear what's happened there either, whether they've noticed that everyone's getting all upset about this and have responded or whatever it is.
The plot thickens. We will follow this story. But before then, Vertical Chicken Farming Live, taking the journey from music copyright infringements to
chickens.
Yeah, this is a fairly dystopian future for chicken farming that was conjured up by an architecture student at the Royal College of Art. And he's proposed a system where you would remove the chickens' cerebral cortexes so that they didn't experience the horrors of being packed together tightly into vertical farms. And as such, you'd be able to squish many, many more chickens in together and therefore be able to create more meat to meet demand.
So he wants to stuff a load of chickens with no brains together.
Exactly.
Is that what he's saying?
Essentially, yes. I don't think it's
in great big sheds.
I don't think it's in
vertical farms. They would be in these kind of very matrix style kind of pods that they'd be growing up in these huge kind of vertical skyscrapers of chickens.
The UK produces and kills just under 1 billion battery farm chickens every year. And that, by the sounds of it, is not actually quite enough. And this would be a way to increase that supply, but at the same time, perhaps do so in a more humane way.
Yeah, it's a kind of very much a thought piece kind of experiment. And what he's saying is that the broiler chickens, that the 800 million broiler chickens, have a rubbish life. They grow up in sheds. They never see the light of day. They grow so quickly their legs can't accommodate their weight. They, you know, their lungs pack out. They eat each other. It's a hideous environment to grow up. And we get them nicely packaged in the supermarket and never see any of that. His concept was inspired by this idea called the blind chicken solution by a philosopher called Paul Thompson from Purdue University, who discovered that a strain of chicken that was bred to be bred by mistake and that happened to be blind did not mind being packed in as closely as other breeds of chickens. And so, you know, this lack of this one sense made them more less traumatized by being packed in close together. And so he's gone, and Andre Ford, the student, has gone a step further and said that if they can't experience, you know, sight, sound, you know, feeling, that they then it's not, is it cruel to the chicken to be packed in these horrible circumstances?
Essentially, what they can't feel can't harm them.
Yeah,
but also they would actually leave the brain intact itself, because the brain needs to be there. So obviously the chicken is alive and is growing and developing.
It's alive, it's growing and developing. I mean, he proposes having electrical stimulation to make sure the muscle grows. It's all very terrifying.
And how would they eat? And how would they drink? I mean,
they'd be fed by a network of tubes, would give them their food and their water, and then their excrement would be taken away in the same way. It would be this really industrial, kind of modern, hideous piece of kind of farming.
Before people get too freaked out, can I sort of ask whether he's, I guess whether he's addressed the moral issues here, because there are clearly moral issues here. Has he sort of dealt with that and engaged with that?
He has, but only in so much as he's highlighting how horrific the conditions that the chickens that we eat at the moment are.
Okay, so that's the real point here, is it? Is it that he's making the point that currently things are terrible for chickens, and it's drawing attention to that,
yeah,
by proposing what could be seen as an even worse solution?
Yeah, I mean, he posted a video of the kind of slaughterhouse from an organic farm. And, you know, that's a very nice, chickens have grown up, really had a lovely lifestyle. But if you watch the video, it's very shocking. And he says that his concept is no more shocking than the processes that take place, even at the very best level of our chicken farming kind of current existing processes. And so he said, you know, anyone who saw the broiler chickens would find this a palatable alternative.
Well, I've seen videos of what broiler chickens go through, and it's not pleasant. It is hideous. It is far better, you know, obviously for free range. But this also does have the distinct advantage, at least according to your story, that this could allow us to have a density of 11.7 chickens per cubic meter instead of 3.2, which is the current average.
Yeah.
And that is a huge number of chickens. And if we're producing 800 million a year at a density of 3.2, then we're talking, well, you know, like 2 billion chickens a year could be produced and without them suffering. I mean, obviously, if this did take off and was entirely the process was moved over to this guy's idea, but
yeah,
still.
I mean, there's a massive moral can of worms there in terms of what right do we have to remove the feelings or the perceptions of another animal. But I guess,
well, what right do we have to shove 3.2 of them into a cubic meter space?
Well, and exactly,
and not 11 point whatever it is, 7.
Well,
I mean, I guess the thing here is just we could just eat less chicken, couldn't we?
Yeah.
That's the simple solution here.
We've got some pictures of his concepts for this on the website. Slightly harrowing.
If you can stomach them.
Yeah, I mean, well, they're not that bad. They're not that bad, but they are a little grisly, but they are on wide.co.uk if you search for chicken
matrix.
Yeah, I think chicken matrix.
Vertical chicken farms.
Virtual chicken farms. There you go. And let us know what you think, podcast@wired.co.uk, particularly if you've seen those photos. We're going to move on to something slightly more cheery. The UK's first amphibious house is to be built 10 metres off the edge of the Thames, which is pretty cool. This will be the first time a house in the UK is going to be on a set of what are essentially stilts. And if it floods, the house will simply float and rise up rather than being on a set of giant poles like they are in around the world, and it is permanent, like a house in the clouds. This could just be a regular house at a regular level with a regular garden, but if it floods, the house floats and moves up.
So it floats up as the waters rise up. It's got a series of floats around it. Is that how it works?
It is. So think about it, about the cistern in a toilet. You know, it has that ball and the little arm. When the water rises in the system, it floats up. Imagine that ball, Duncan, is a house you can live in. It's like that.
Isn't that what a houseboat is? But this is only for flooding.
Well, no, because a houseboat would permanently be flooding. It would permanently be floating. This is so you can have a
ground.
Fairly normal house that if it does happen to flood, because it's in a place that can flood, then the house will float.
Okay.
And how would it work with, I guess, sort of utilities? You know, how would you get water to it and electricity and other things?
Well, that's the thing. I'm not entirely sure. I think we'll know more once they actually start building this. It's actually going to be built later this year. But I imagine it's no more difficult, really, than, you know, wiring brake cables through a BMX handlebar or something. You know, these are stilts that are probably hollow, and you can wire stuff up through there. And obviously, cables from the top of the house can connect to pylons and things like that. And not forgetting, you know, wireless technologies these days are kind of all over the place.
And where are they building these things again?
It's going to be in Buckinghamshire, so north of London. And the company, Barker Architects, are going to be working on 700 similar homes planned for Norwich. So if you're in Norwich, like Alan Partridge, maybe you'll get a floating house next year or later. Right, let's move on to space, Duncan. Tell me about the space-clearing satellite. Or space junk clearing satellite.
Yeah, the Swiss have a fairly short history in space. Their first orbiting satellite was launched in 2009, and it's now outlived its usefulness. And like a responsible satellite owner, they want to pull it down out of orbit safely and effectively, so it doesn't smash into another satellite and explode into loads of tiny little bits.
So a satellite's going to go up into space and pull down a bit of old satellite.
Yeah, it's kind of like a galactic bin man, just going up and collecting all the stuff that isn't needed anymore and pulling it back down to Earth so it can be safely recycled and disposed of.
It sounds like an expensive mission.
I think the point is that it's cheaper to do this right now than in the future to suffer, you know, a spacecraft getting smashed into it by another spacecraft in orbit and having to, you know, build another one then.
I think the most exciting thing about this, though, is that Switzerland, I say exciting in the loosest possible sense, but Switzerland kind of wants to sell this technology to other people who want to clean up after themselves.
Yeah, that's the idea. They want to, the director of the Swiss Space Center, Volker Gass, reckons that they want to kind of offer and sell it as a whole family of ready-made systems designed to attach onto, grab onto different types of satellites and pull them out of their orbit, and so that they decay back into the Earth's atmosphere and fall to the ground. And then it's kind of about allowing space agencies to take into consideration the elimination of the stuff they're putting up at the moment. At the moment, it's a one-way process, but you can't keep putting stuff up there forever.
Liv, do you think we need something in space that basically says, please clean up after your space mission, and encourage people to take a little, effectively a little bag.
It only takes a minute to bag it and bin it. That's what I'd say. Well, I don't understand why it can only get one thing at a time. Can't we get it so that it can collect together loads of things and then bring them all down?
Like a sort of big net sort of thing. No, it's not really designed like that. It's more, it kind of goes up, it matches the orbit of its target and then it grabs onto it in a big bear hug, and the combined weight of the two of them and the momentum of it will knock it out of its orbit and then into a decaying spiral until it comes back down to Earth.
So when is this system going to launch, do we know?
Well, Volker Gas says that he hopes it could start cleaning in kind of 3 to 5 years, and it would be a kind of one shot per time go. So you send it up, it grabs a satellite, it comes back down, and then you've got to send another one up to get the next one and so on.
Those astronauts will be hungry after they've been up to space, and a restaurant in Chicago has put an edible helium balloon on its menu. It's a balloon made from dehydrated Granny Smith apples, malic acid and sugar, served with a pin. And it kind of looks like a head-sized bubblegum balloon, only transparent, like cling film, and full of helium.
So just like a regular balloon, but you transparent.
You could say a regular balloon, but it looks, I don't know, bubblegum.
How is this made?
It starts off as a bit of goop, and a pipe goes into it, and they fill through the pipe, they fill it with helium, and then it expands into a balloon-like existence, and then it's served with a pin attached to a piece of apple leather, they call it, which does look like a piece of leather, but it's apple-y or made from apples, with a pin attached to the end, placed in front of the customer, and the customer sort of buries his face in this giant balloon of goop and inhales the helium, and then can pop it and then can eat it.
That sounds awesome.
And it's all edible apart from the pin.
Everything is edible apart from the pin. And it's very key you don't swallow the pin.
Mm.
Very important.
Do you not remember that stuff you could buy in toy shops? And it came in tubes and it looked a bit like coloured glue. And then you'd put it onto the end of this plastic straw and blow it up. And it would kind of create these bubbles that didn't burst immediately. Does anyone else remember that?
Yeah, I remember those.
It seems just like this, but obviously you couldn't eat those.
A bit applier.
Yeah, a little bit applier.
So who made this?
So this is a restaurant in Chicago called Alinea. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it.
They should stop putting videos of people eating this, because you have the helium, you have the delight of receiving it on your plate, and then you have the helium voice, which is always hilarious.
Well, there is a video of a guy eating this, actually.
But does he talk?
Yeah, he does talk, actually. We've got a clip.
So green apple balloon, where you can just put your lips to the balloon and inhale the helium out of it. Second option, we have a pin down at the bottom of the apple leather string there, and you can just kind of poke it if you like, and then enjoy it. The entire thing is edible.
Oh, say, can you see?
That's what it sounds like. How delightful. Awesome. Don't know if it's one of your five a day. Don't know about its nutritional value.
They should do it with laughing gas as well.
That'd be hilarious. Haha, lol. It should be televised, perhaps in 3D, Duncan, if balloon popping becomes an Olympic sport. That's what the BBC's doing.
I don't think that's likely anytime soon.
No, it's not. Tell me about the BBC's Olympic 3D plans.
Well, the BBC has been, it's been wondering for a while exactly what it's going to do about broadcasting the Olympics, especially with all the hype around 3D recently, mostly manufactured by TV companies, of course. Yeah. And they've been asking lots of people and doing a lot of market research, which I guess is the same thing. And they've decided, they've announced their plans, and they're dipping a very cautious toe into 3D waters without going too far.
So what are they doing? Just a couple of sports, couple of events.
They're broadcasting the men's 100 metres final and a daily roundup show in 3D, along with the massively spectacular opening and closing ceremonies.
Yeah, the opening ceremony would be pretty cool, but it seems to me that the 100 metre sprint, or at least the men's final, it's not the most exciting thing to show in 3D from the Olympics. Javelining would be
much fencing.
Better. Fencing, yeah.
Fencing
what would you
good.
See in 3D?
Horse riding, I don't know what they're called, the actual different events, for the
dressage.
One where they jump. No, not that one, the jumpy one. Jumpy, outdoorsy one.
Is that an Olympic sport?
Yeah, it's eventing. I don't know.
Something like that.
I'm a really poor horse fan.
The reason they're doing this is because broadcasting in 3D obviously uses twice the bandwidth that broadcasting in 2D does, because you're broadcasting two images essentially at the same time. And to do that, you've only got a certain amount of bandwidth available. So by doing that, you're lessening the amount of other sports you can show at the same time on the red button. The way the red button works is it kind of broadcasts... a different TV stream at the same time, and you can tune into whichever one you want, but you've got to cram those into a certain amount of space. And if one of those is in 3D, it takes up twice the space ish that it would otherwise.
And that's why we're only getting selective
that's
events.
Why we're but because the BBC doesn't want to reduce people's red button options just so that it can show something in 3D.
And let's not forget about the more obvious factor here, that no one really has a 3D set. No one cares about 3D except for cinema owners and the movie industry. And this just seems like something they're almost compelled to do because, you know, as the public broadcaster, you have a duty
to
provide innovation and programming on different services, and this is one of those types of services.
Yeah, they said they want to kind of experiment with it. Roger Mosey, who's the BBC's director of London 2012, said 3D has spread more slowly than we perhaps expected back in 2009, and there have been interesting developments abroad, with France's Canal Plus announcing that it's stopping its 3D channel because it hasn't met its targets. So it's clear that 3D broadcasting elsewhere hasn't been terribly successful, and so the BBC doesn't want to get caught up in too much commitment towards it just for the time being. It's just going to experiment instead.
Roll on 4K.
Smell-o-vision, that's what I want.
Ignore smell-o-vision.
I want to sniff shot putters.
I want to sniff an ad break, and that's good because one is making its way up my nostrils right now. But when we come back, we're going to discuss why Liv is donating her brain to science.
Wired magazine, now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. Now, we've got a couple of things we want to delve into to discuss. And the first is that, Liv, you wrote a piece the other day about how you're going to donate and why you're going to donate your brain to science after you die. And it's a really fascinating topic, and I think it's important that we talk about it. So why are you going to donate your brain to science when you die?
Yeah, it's not because it's got any particular value in its own right. It's because I went to a talk recently at GV Art Gallery, and they had a neuropharmacologist called David Dexter and a neuropathologist called Stephen Gentleman, and both of them work for Parkinson's UK Brain Bank. And what they do is they get donated tissue to do lots of different experiments on to make better drugs for horrible diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Now, they have a massive lack of donated brains, particularly the healthy brains. So they think they've got around 1,100 brains in their tissue bank, and of them, only 117 are healthy brains. Now, for every experiment that you do on disease tissue, you need a control piece of tissue from a healthy brain. And without that, you're severely holding up lots of different experiments that they want to do.
But donating your brain isn't quite just as simple as filling out a regular donor card, is it? There's a big process involved.
Exactly. The National Organ Donor Register only works for organs that you can transplant. It's not about donating to science, it's about donating so that someone else can use your organ. So as such, the brain isn't included because you can't yet transplant a brain. So in order to donate your brain, you have to sign up to a completely separate register. You have to find one of these tissue banks, such as the Parkinson's UK Brain Bank, and sign up to the program to donate your brain. You have to get a next of kin to sign up as well. And then when you die, someone has to then ring the brain bank up. There's no automated process as there is with the organ donor registry. You actually have to get a grieving relative to then call up the brain bank, and then they come and try and retrieve it within 24 hours.
And that's not the same as with an organ, because with an organ, the doctor, in a hospital at least, would pronounce you dead, sign your death certificate, and then would start the process for transplant. But that's not the same with the brain.
No, you have to actually actively call up the brain bank rather than there being any kind of central database as there is with this organ donor registry.
So the process by which you donate your brain is obviously an inhibiting factor here, and one of the reasons they don't have many brains in their brain bank. But the other thing as well is, of course, that the brain is a bit more sensitive as a thing to donate. It's cutting into the head, you know, rather than just heart and lungs.
Yeah, and there's a number of things that are an issue here. Some people of different faiths believe that the brain is somehow linked to the soul, so that makes people a bit squeamish or a bit reluctant to donate. The other thing is that people, family members, are worried about how the person's going to look afterwards, you know, when they're in their casket. And again, they try to allay people's fears by saying that it's very much hidden. You wouldn't be able to notice after the brain's been removed that it has been removed. And I'm sorry for going into the gory detail, but this is kind of important stuff that people always ask questions about.
So what happens to the brain after it's removed?
So once they've taken it out, they whisk it off to the tissue bank where they cut it in half down the middle. And one hemisphere is then suspended in formalin, which is a kind of preservative. And they use that to forensically analyse what the conditions that person actually had, because they might have been misdiagnosed in their life. Now, the other hemisphere is a bit that's used for research, and it's sliced up into 2 centimetre by 2 centimetre blocks, mapped so that they know where those blocks were within the brain. And then it's snap frozen between these Teflon coated plates that are cooled by liquid nitrogen, so that you get these perfectly frozen little cubes of brain.
Sort of brain cubes.
Brain cubes, which you can
go and drink.
Which then get stored until someone needs them for research. And I think one brain can do, I think it's around 100 different experiments you can do with the brain.
So they're basically figuratively in jars in a brain bank.
Yeah.
How does somebody say, I want to use a piece of brain for some of my research? I mean, does someone have a key to the brains?
Who has the key to the brain? Who's the brain master?
The tissue bank, the brain bank, is the representatives there are the key masters, but you have to apply to them with your proposed experiment, and they decide whether or not they think it's going to be beneficial for their particular cause, which is of, I think, dementia, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's in this case. And then they'll give you a piece of brain for free.
So you have made the decision to support the cause and actually specify that you want your brain, your healthy brain, to be donated to science.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, there's forms that you can collect. If you go onto the Brain Bank website, there's a Parkinson's isn't the only brain bank, but it's one of the leading ones in the UK. But you can go on there. There's lots of forms you can download and you can sign. And then you need to get a next of kin to sign, and you'll send them off. And they'll contact you, I think, every 2 years to get your consent again.
Well, I mean, I think it's an admirable thing to do to donate your brain. It is genuinely something that I want to consider myself. But if anyone listening is considering it, then you've got a fascinating story on the website. If you search for donate brain, I think you'll find your piece. And I strongly encourage anyone to do so. Our last little discussion point in the second half of our show today is about something less cerebral, quite literally. It's the iPad 3. There have been quite a lot of rumours surrounding the tablet. We haven't talked much tech today, so we thought we'd drop this one in. There have been a lot of rumours that the iPad 3 is going to get announced at the beginning of March.
But you don't think it will?
I think it'll be announced at the beginning of March, but certain sources hinted to me that it may be launching in the UK at the end of March. And we have a rundown of popular rumours that we believe may end up in the iPad 3. So I thought I'd go through these just to give you a little hint of what we might expect in the UK in March. The first is a Retina display. So that's the super high-res, high-pixel density type of display that we've seen in the iPhone 4S. Now imagine one of those, but about four times bigger. That would provide a resolution so high that on a 9.7-inch screen, you would have a resolution higher than what you get on a 17-inch laptop. So more than twice the number of pixels in less than half the amount of space, which is a hugely high-res screen. That in itself is amazing.
That would be impressive to see, definitely. I mean, what resolution does the iPad run at the moment?
The current iPad 2 is 1024 by 768 pixels, which is, fairly standard 4x3 resolution. But this new one could be as high as 2048 by 1536 pixels.
Which is, about four times the size?
Yeah, I mean, that would be significantly higher than a high-definition full HD screen, but on something less than 10 inches across diagonally, which would be pretty amazing, particularly, I think, for photographs and obviously movies and videos and stuff. But you need a better processor in there to process stuff, and particularly 3D graphics at those sort of huge resolutions. So we reckon we're going to see a quad-core processor on the inside, which would be one of Apple's that it develops itself, probably called the A6.
And what would that chip then, do you think, be rolled out to other devices as well?
It's hard to say. I mean, those chips at those sort of clock speeds would probably eat up juice quite considerably and wouldn't necessarily be needed, if it wasn't driving a massive high-def screen, like high-resolution screen like that. But one of the other things it could have is HD cameras for like HD video calling. It's something that they've had in the Mac, in the MacBooks for a little while now, HD FaceTime, so we could see some of those. And I reckon Siri, the voice control thing,
I'd be surprised if we didn't see that coming in the next in the next update. I mean, there are some technical reasons why it can't be brought to previous devices. Is that right?
It's believed so. It's believed that the processor, the Apple A5 chip in the iPhone 4S, is specifically designed by Apple to use this technology, and that wouldn't be supported on a lower spec chip. That's why you can't get Siri on the iPhone 4. But we have seen iPhone 4s hacked to support Siri. So whether or not that is true or whether it's just an efficiency thing is not so sure. But the other thing I think is interesting about this is that Apple is making such a huge push into the education market with things like iTunes U and with getting iPads into schools, that it would make sense to keep a budget version of the iPad around. And so I honestly think that we will see the iPad 2 stick around, but be at a lower price, or a slightly different version of what is essentially the iPad 2, you know, with less storage or something like that, so they could sell these things into schools at a much lower cost. Because, you know, having a giant Retina display on a quad-core tablet is not going to be cheap. So we're looking out for an announcement on the 7th, and probably a launch in the UK at the end of March.
Do you want to put a date on it?
I would say the 26th of March.
26th of March.
Yeah. Okay.
Mark it in your calendars, ladies and gentlemen.
Or the 27th. And that is the end of our show.
Lovely.
We don't have a feature this week because we thought we'd spend a lot of time talking about the brains. And I think it's only fair, Liv, that you tell people how they can get in touch.
Yeah, you can follow us on Twitter. We're on at Wired UK. And we're also on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/WiredUK.
And that is strictly our members club. For our fans, for our behind-the-scenes action, isn't it, Duncan?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that the right answer to that question?
The answer's yes, yeah.
Okay.
But we also have an email
address. Yes, definitely. And you can email us at podcast@wired.co.uk. None of you sent us kisses last week after I asked you to. I was really hurt, especially on Valentine's Day. I was checking the inbox. There was nothing there. I was so disappointed.
If you want to kiss Duncan.
Kiss all of us.
At Duncan Gear.
And we'll see you for a hug and a kiss next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Did my sniff come through?
Sadly.